It's Sunday morning. Time for the Great Outdoors with Charlie Potter. Brought to you by the all-new Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome to the Great Outdoors Show. Charlie Potter, your host here on WGN Radio as we begin Thanksgiving week, Thursday being Thanksgiving, a time when so many of us travel to be with our families, which means an awful lot of us spend time outdoors. And whether it's going to be walking on the lakefront in Chicago or walking in a forest preserve or hunting wherever you might be in Missouri or Minnesota or wherever you're listening to the show, hunting seasons are open across America right now. And it's a great family time, and I'll come back to that a little bit towards the end. I'm going to start off the show talking about an experience I recently had, which was so incredible. It was not filmed, and I'm going to do my very best to describe over the radio what it was like. I have seen the single best Labrador retriever I've ever seen in my life, and I've been blessed not only to own wonderful labs, but to have seen wonderfully trained labs. And so many of you listening, I know, have labs that either you hunt with or labs that sit on the couch with you or whatever they might do. You love your labs. We love our dogs. But I saw a performance by a Labrador retriever that I'm going to describe to you for the next few minutes that hopefully gives you a sense of just what's almost beyond comprehension. The dog's name is Sam, and its owner's name is Brad. And I was recently in Utah hunting with Sam, 7-year-old black lab female, and Brad, its owner. To start off with, we were pheasant hunting, and we were hunting in rows of corn. So envision the corn being harvested and leaving strips about 10 or so strips wide, so about a 30-foot wide strip, and then harvested in between standing strips. So you've got a 30-foot wide strip that maybe runs for a quarter or half a mile, and you've got harvested corn for maybe 75, 100 yards, and then you have another strip running half a mile. So we stood in the middle between these two strips, and Brad looked at his dog, Sam, who sat there, and he said, "Back." And Sam simply took a line and started to run straight down the field, if you're visioning going east to west, straight down the field for about 100 yards, equidistant between the two rows of standing strips, which are about 100 yards apart. And there it turned around and sat down. And Brad raised his hand again and pushed back with his hand and said, "Way back." Sam took off and ran another at least 100 yards, turned around and sat down. Brad, no whistle involved. Brad raised his hand again, pushed back, and said, "Way, way back." Sam ran another, probably well over a quarter mile in total, till it reached the end of the field where it turned and sat down, and you could barely see the dog. At which point, it looked at Brad. Brad put his hand out, but there was no way the dog could hear him. Put his hand out, his arm, and thrust it to the left, and said, "Go left." You heard what I said. I'm going to get back to that in a second. And the dog took off left and ran about 40 yards till it got to the end of the corn strip. And we were a quarter of a mile at the other end of the corn strip, at which point the dog started to hunt back towards us. Imagine this. What Brad had done is trained his dog to run to the end of corn strips and then to hunt the corn strips back towards him, flushing the birds as it came towards him. What happens, all of you pheasant hunters know, what happens when you're hunting corn strips is the pheasants always run out ahead. They're usually out of range. They get up and they fly away, or they run to the very end of the strip and then they all flush out of range. Not all of them, but most of them. In this case, Sam just diligently hunted her way back down the corn strip. No language, nothing from Brad. We just stood there at the other end of the corn strip, basically with our mouths agape, not believing what we were seeing, with pheasants popping out every so often as Sam worked her way down the corn strip towards us. And when she got to us all the way, she had flushed all the pheasants in the corn strip. They had flown mostly wide of us, but nonetheless, it was a driven pheasant shoot by a dog that had been trained to do this. So if that wasn't enough, after we finished pheasant hunting, we went on what turned out to be an absolutely epic duck hunt. We were in a blind out in open water, in the middle of a pond, and the nearest dry land was probably 150 yards in either direction to our left and right, and easily a mile in length, basically no dry land. And over the course of the next 3 hours, this dog, Sam, was not able to see where the birds were falling because of the way the blind was set up, would jump in the water, and Brad would simply say to the dog, go left or go right. You know, we're taught to throw our hands left or right. Brad just said, go left, go right. And I asked him, why did you train your dog to go left or right? He said, because when they're in cattails and heavy brush, think about all this, you've hunted pheasants or ducks, cattails and heavy brush, they can't see you. They can hear you, but they can't see you. So it does no good to thrust your arm to the left or right because they can't see you. So he said, I've taught my dog, go left, go right, and it knows it's left or it's right. So he put the dog at sit in front of me and told it to go left, and it went left. Told it to go right, it went right. So the dog would jump in the water and swim, and he would say back. And then the dog would swim for a ways, and he would say, go way back. And the same thing, and then would turn and look at him, and he would say, go left, go right. He directed that dog several times across 200 to 300 yards of open water, all with just hand signals. And then it would hit the bank and look at him. And then with a hand signal, it would either go left or right up and down the bank until it found the bird. And it did this repeatedly. No, very little whistling, never a raised voice. And then when you had more than one or two ducks in the water in front of you, it would swim out, it would stop the dog, and he could call the dog off one duck and send it to a duck that might be a harder retrieve. The dog was probably in the water for an hour or more out of the three-hour hunt retrieving birds. I would guess it swam 4 or 5 miles if you think about it all together, all of which was done with go back, go way back, go left, go right. You dog trainers, I know Doug James, you're probably listening to the show at Donnybrook Kennel and others. You're probably thinking that, Charlie, there's no way. I can tell you that I have seen the most incredible Labrador retriever in the field that I have ever seen. So I just wanted to convey that because all of us who have dogs, we all have our experiences, and we think we've got great dogs. And I like to think I've had great dogs, and I have. I've never seen anything like this. And no, Brad's not a professional trainer. You can't call him up and say, will you train my dog? He just works with his dogs, and he trains them for the condition in which they are going to hunt. And he told me, my dog basically knows everything it's going to do by the time it's 9 months old. After 9 months old, it's repetition. The dog never broke once. And when I say broke, for those of you who may not be familiar, it means when a gun goes off, the dog jumps in the water and tries to swim or run to see where the bird is. The dog never even flinched. He said from the very first retrieve of that dog as a puppy, the very first one, I never let it break. He said, labs are bred to want to go and retrieve. So he said, even as a puppy, I didn't throw a dummy and let it go run after and bring it back and congratulate it. I made it sit right there. And then when I sent it, it could go back. So it was trained from its very earliest memories not to go get something unless it's sent. So I have seen, I just have to say, I hope I've described this in a way that you can envision. I have seen the magical dog and a magical dog, a hunter, who is the dog whisperer. What Sam put on for the show that day in the marshes of Utah is so extraordinary, and if I ever have the chance to do it again, I'm going to film it. So when you take your dogs in the field, think about how they'll respond to you, and all this was done in a calm voice, never voice raised. Remarkable. That's my dog story for the day. Sam and Brad, the best combination of hunting dog, Labrador retriever, and man I've ever seen. I'll be back with much more on the Great Outdoors. When I come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about the new ruling from the EPA and wetlands. And I'm also going to talk about flying dogs during this holiday season. And if I have time, what's going on in Colorado with wolves. Thanks so much for listening. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN. And now a message from our longtime sponsors, the Northwest Indiana and Chicagoland Chevrolet dealers.
Hiking, camping, and hunting, it's all an adventure in the great outdoors, but nature can be tough. You need to be ready for anything and everything. Chevy Silverado is built to handle the toughest conditions and get you everywhere you want to go worry-free. Silverado's designed to handle the big jobs. It's built for the great outdoors. With over 13,000 pounds of towing capacity and trailering sway control, Silverado can haul the biggest loads on the roughest roads and keep you cool as a Sunday drive. With 8 available cameras and up to 14 different views, it can spot trouble before it gets to you. That's peace of mind. And when you're ready for the backcountry, Chevy Silverado 1500 ZR2 owns the off-road. You name it, we run over it. No wonder it's Motor Trend's 2023 four-wheeler pickup truck of the year. So see your Chicagoland and Northwest Indiana Chevy dealer or go to ChevyDriveChicago.com and check out a Chevy Silverado. It's freedom to explore the great outdoors.
It's Charlie Potter and the Great Outdoors on Chicago's very own 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Great Outdoors Show. Hope you enjoyed that tale of a phenomenal hunting dog. Phenomenal dog. Let's talk for a moment about the EPA and wetlands. The Supreme Court a few years ago made a major ruling on wetlands that basically said wetlands are not the waters of the United States unless they are attached directly to a navigable river or surface water that is the water of the United States. The EPA now has followed up on that, and that reversed about 50 years of Supreme Court rulings. The EPA has followed up on that to try to clarify what that means. So private landowners, by and large, have protested for decades what they believe is the overreach of the federal government in dictating how they manage wetlands on their property. I'm going to take this approach for a moment. They're right. They're right with a caveat. When wetlands are drained, everything flows downstream, and flooding is exacerbated downstream. What we have done in the draining of wetlands, and by the way, if you think of Illinois, we have lost 99% of our wetlands. Iowa, 95. Indiana, 99. Wisconsin, over 90%. Minnesota, over 90%. The entire Midwest has been gutted of its wetlands that have been existed since the last glacier melted. And we wonder why we have bad flooding. What you're seeing in Florida with Lake Okeechobee and the Everglades, it's either starved for water or it has so much water it's drowning. That's because there's so much development now, Orlando and the whole area north of the Everglades, and all of it's just put into pipes instead of letting it come down naturally through the aquifers. Same things happen all across America. Flooding is caused by the loss of wetlands. Yes, before we ever got here, or even when we first settled this country, we had enormous floods. The great floods of the Mississippi River are biblical in the context that they're so absolutely overpowering of anything man has tried to do to stop them. The 1927 flood of the Mississippi, which will be 100 years in recognition next year, or 2 years from now, the worst flood really known to America. But today, the loss of wetlands is driving most of the flooding we have. The flooding on the Illinois River, I hate to use this term, is really nothing but a sewer pipe for northern Illinois and the city of Chicago and the Chicago suburbs. The Illinois was one of the most pristine, magnificent rivers on the face of the earth. 150 years ago, it was not really so much a river as it was just a series of slowly moving lakes, slowly moving water between lakes. And the Illinois River barely flowed because its gradient was so flat, and it is so flat. But hundreds of lakes were formed off the Illinois River. Today, they're gone. The Illinois River is just a pipe, basically a channelized river to move water as fast as it can to the Mississippi the same way. The result is, as we have drained all the wetlands, and let's say you're a farmer, as many of you are listening, and you've got a half an acre slough in your back, in a field somewhere, and you go and put that into a drainage pipe, that drainage pipe goes to the road, that road goes to somewhere else, that roadside ditch goes to somewhere else, next thing you know, it's in a river, in a stream to a river, and on down to the Mississippi. That's what's happening, and it's happening over thousands of miles, so we have lost our ability to retain surface water. When it rains or snows, the runoff is now instantaneous. Just look around Chicago. Look what happens with things called the Skokie Ditch, of all things, right? These are just big flood channels that get overwhelmed. It's true across America, the Yazoo Basin in Mississippi, the entire Yazoo Basin now, because of the amount of drainage at the north end, is causing terrific flooding at the south end of the Yazoo Basin. You can look at every single watershed in America, and you can see the results of wetland drainage. So we've lost 99% of our wetlands in Illinois. You could say, how many more do we have to lose? We got 1% of what was left. That's still a fair number of wetlands. So the EPA ruling, I'm afraid, does not take into account the sponge effect and the water purification effect of wetlands. We're all in this together, and I believe a private landowner has the right to do on their private lands what they see fit, providing it doesn't cause damage to the public. In our case, draining of wetlands by private landowners is causing damage to the general public because all water flows downstream. And if you're a farmer listening to me today in central Illinois, Springfield, let's say, the Vermilion River, you are affected by what's happening 200 miles north of you by wetlands being drained. And the farmer listening in Missouri is affected by what's happening 200 miles north of them. Why does Des Moines have such a terrible water quality and flooding problem? Because all the wetlands basically north of Des Moines to the Canadian border have been drained. So we're at a period where before we go and start completely opening up, can we drain more wetlands? We really have to understand the consequence of where this water goes. And I would offer, we as a country are at the point where we really can't put much water in the quote-unquote pipe. We can't take it. We've got to figure out how to keep water on the landscape, and whether that's retention ponds or whatever it might be, but we can't keep just sending unmitigated amounts of water south. 1 minute left. Let me just quickly go to flying dogs at this holiday season. I promise I'll do wolves in Colorado next week. Pretty hard to fly a dog right now. Those of you who, like me, for decades flew your dogs, flew them on hunting trips, flew them when you went on vacation, wherever you went, if you had to take a dog, you took it with you. Good luck trying to do that now. The airlines have basically made it prohibitively expensive to fly a dog, and they simply don't want to fly dogs. So the dog business of transporting dogs, and for all of you listening who in America who may be headed to Florida or Arizona or wherever you're going to head for the winter, you know what I'm talking about. Your dogs, by and large, unless they fit in the cabin with you under your seat, they have to be driven. The driving dog business is a great business. The flying dog business is almost out of business. And I don't understand why the airlines have taken such a hostile role to the traveling humans traveling with pets, but they certainly have, make it very difficult on all of us. Thanks so much for listening. I'll be back next week with much more in the great outdoors. This is Charlie Potter on the Outdoor Voice of Chicago and America, 720 WGN.